Welcome to The Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series created by Robert Jordan.
At its conclusion, the series will consist of 14 novels and one prequel novel.
Sadly, Robert Jordan did not live to see his work complete.
Brandon Sanderson, appointed by Mr. Jordan's widow, Harriet Rigney, will complete the series with the novels The Gathering Storm, Towers of Midnight, and A Memory of Light, based on the notes left by Mr. Jordan.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Fourth Age. I, of course, am Andrew Gellos, and with me this time is Virginia.
Hi, Andrew. It's great to be here, as always. And we have a special guest for this episode, Jennifer, from JordanCon.
Hey, everybody.
Jennifer.
It's good to be here. Hi, Virginia.
So, when I said welcome to the Fourth Age at the beginning of this podcast, for the first time, I can actually mean it. We are broadcasting live from the actual Fourth Age.
Dun, dun, dun.
The end of an age. The beginning of a new age.
Yes, this is our first recorded podcast following the release of the final volume in the Wheel of Time series, A Memory of Light. So we are going to give you our honest and first reactions to having read the end of the series. That being said, by now, if you don't recognize that we're going to be talking spoilers from the end of the season, or it's not season, but the series, you really should probably re-examine listening to this particular podcast. We're going to be talking about anything and everything in this last volume, and possibly some stuff from before, but mostly this last volume. So if you're not done with the series yet, and you really care about spoilers, please, please, please don't listen. Come back once you've finished the book, and then you can be like, oh my god, he was so right, or he was so wrong, and it'll be great.
Well, after at this point in time, there's not going to be much left for us to spoil. We pretty much... it's out there. It's not going to be any spoiler warnings after this.
Or rather, there's nothing but spoiler warnings on the whole series.
Well, that's true. If someone hasn't read it. Can you imagine coming to this series now for the first time? Would that not be beyond awesome to be able to just sit down for the first time with book one and go all the way through it without any breaks or interruptions?
That seems really weird to me. Because so much of the experience with the Wheel of Time is the waiting and the discussing of what's going to happen next.
I have someone who is essentially a sister to me who swore she would never pick the series up until the last book was out for fear that the author would die before he finished the series. And once Robert Jordan passed, I looked at her and I said, you know what? There's a new author who's finishing the series. It will be done. Once it is done, I will let you know and you can begin reading the series. So I do actually know someone who has this potential to read through all the 14 books without having anything preconceived in their mind. So it'll be interesting to see.
Well, make sure you interject New Spring at the appropriate time.
Yes. After book one.
I don't know, somebody told me one later than that, I think maybe book five or six, so that it made more sense. But
What do you think? I think when Lee did her reread on Tor.com, she did that one before Knife of Dreams.
Book one, I think, is a little too soon.
It's in publication order.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I know from Spencer and I helping at the BYU Midnight Release Party, we were approached by a couple different people who were just reporting on the event itself, who actually hadn't read the series. And I know talking to one of them myself when I was done, you know, explaining my thoughts and feelings on the series as a whole, you know, he was like, I'm going to go buy a few of those books now. And so it was really nice because I can say that I contributed to beginning someone into the series. So that was really neat too. So as we are kicking this off, how about we just go around? I guess we'll begin with Jennifer. What were your first, like, general impression or reaction to this last volume?
The first thing I thought was, wow, Brandon did it. He actually managed to finish it. And the ending is a good ending. There's that sadness that you get that the series is done. There's the satisfaction of it being done. There's the joyfulness that comes with the celebration of a new book coming out. And there's also the sadness that Robert Jordan wasn't here to finish it with us.
Yeah, it is definitely a mixed bag of emotions, I think, for everybody. It is really good to have a sense of closure that it's finally done. I don't know, I suppose, as my general impression, it was a little mixed, too. I can't say I didn't enjoy the book. I really did. I mean, I could barely put it down. There were some scenes of absolute, complete awesomeness that will stay with me forever. But I think on the whole, I might have been a little disappointed, but that's probably only because my expectations were so high. And it's just been so long that we've been waiting for it. I don't know if anybody could have come up with anything. I don't even know if Robert Jordan could have come up with anything that would have really...
I very deliberately for years now have not made any theories or predictions as to what Rand Fight in the Dark One was going to be like or what the end of the book was going to be, because I didn't want to build something up in my mind and have it be like the perfect ending that Jennifer thought of and then it not happen and then I would be mad. And so I very deliberately have not done any kind of like last book prediction kind of stuff because I didn't want to make myself crazy like that.
Yeah. I mean, I myself, as I was going through it, and I look back now at the experience of reading through the last book the first time, I, a couple months back, read Lee Butler's spoiler-free reaction to the book. I remember thinking this morning as I was preparing for this podcast, going, you know what, I bet you I could go back now and pinpoint exactly where along the story all of those reactions in that spoiler-free one went.
Oh, yeah.
Because I personally, as I began reading the book on my flights home from Utah, and I am very, very happy that people seem to assume that I was having problems with like sinuses or allergies and that, because it was, there were some moments that were just so emotionally wrought, and it was coming off of this, you know, nearly 24 hours of assisting with the BYU release party that we were, you know, everything was so tightly wound that I was tearing up, and I will freely admit it.
You're vulnerable.
Well, and on top of that, I happened to be near Maria from Team Jordan when the final 10, 9, 8 countdown happened.
Wow.
For her, you know, it was a momentous moment. I could tell, you know, she was getting a little teary too, and someone had asked her shortly afterwards, you know, well, how long have you been working on this? And she was like, you know, 17 years, you know, she was directly involved in it. And so, I mean, it was so huge, and I could tell it was so huge for her that I was like, oh my God, I want to run up and hug you, but I, you know, really feel awkward about doing that because I've interviewed you a couple times, but we don't really know each other very well. So it was one of those things. So I did not end up, you know, hugging a deal of time royalty, even though I wanted to. So
I could have hugged her and it would have been okay.
Yeah.
As I'm going through, you know, I'm sitting here reading through the book, and it was just like, oh, yep, got that right, got that right. What?
What?
And, you know, and I would yell or laugh out loud or something, and, you know, my wife, who hasn't,
wait,
you know, Samantha? Obviously hadn't been, you know, and I'm gonna relish when I get to those moments again with her, because then I'll be able to see her reaction and see if they're anything like my own.
I kept getting these texts from Andrew regarding Samantha, and it was so funny. But I can't really repeat them on the air here.
Yeah, I used a particular expletive when referring to Samantha a number of times.
Oh,
I get these two-word texts. These two-word texts. Expletive deleted Samantha.
I need to tell you guys the Samantha story, or my Samantha story, okay? Like, there's the whole thing where, like, Rand thinks that it's Roger, and he shows up, and he's like, what? No, you're not him. Never mind.
Oh, no.
But then the real Demandra shows up, and it's Bao. For those who don't go to JordanCon, Bao is the director of programming for JordanCon. Bao.
No. Oh, my God.
So, yeah. His name is very similar to Beowulf, and... Brandon brought in a whole bunch of Beowulf and old English mythology into Shara, and he used Bao's name for that. So that's Bao's fan cameo is being
Oh my
fan.
God.
Yeah.
That is brilliant.
Like, when I read that part, Like, I was like, am I allowed to swear on this show?
Sure. We can always cut it out.
I think I started screaming at my husband, f***ing bow! Oh, my God! You want to see what his cameo is?
Well, that's exactly what Andy was texting me.
Uh-huh.
Demanded.
Then I was like, sit on it, because I read the book in August, because I did the beta read. And so I've been sitting on, like, this fan cameo for, like, the last couple months. I'm like, I can't tell him.
Okay, so what's the official pronunciation of the last part? Is it the wild or the wild?
The wild, I think.
The wild.
I haven't heard Brandon say that out loud, but it looks like wild to me.
No, I think so, too, but it's hard to know.
And now that you mention the Beowulf connection, that makes so much sense then, particularly in the title of, you know, Dragon Slayer and everything.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm one of those people who looks for the mythologies influencing a particular series. So it was that is interesting and really nice to know, because then that gives, and it also gives a little more credence to Galad and what happened with him.
The whole story makes a lot more sense now. I've already told him I'm changing his badge name at Jordan Con to Demandred.
That was so stupid. I tend to get the mythological references more on the second time around. The first time around, I tend to do it as such a marathon that because I can't wait to get it all in, I don't take it in probably as much as I should. Not really skimming it, but too anxious to really enjoy it, you know what I mean? I mean, I enjoy it, but you know what I mean. I don't catch as many nuances because I tend to read when I'm really tired just because I can't stop.
Oh, yeah. That's why I like The Wheel of Time so much, because it's very rereadable. I can read it the first time to get the plot, and then I can read it the second time or third time or fourth time or whatever to catch all the nuances and things that I'd missed before. I always find something new when I reread.
And I know, even after about the 10th time on some of the books, I still catch things, and I go, how did it suck? All those times around. Oh, going back to Demandred for just a moment, I probably should leave this for the section of, you know, what will we write and what will we wrong. But I was like, oh, score. Yes, there's that missing songreel. Thank you. Mm-hmm. The one that Lanfear told Rand about so many, many, many books ago in Stone of Tear, the missing songreel. I knew it was there somewhere. I knew somebody was going to come up with it. I never expected it to be Demandred. I actually, and there were so many hints, but I didn't see Shara coming at all. But anyway, like I say, I'm jumping ahead a little bit.
Well, that's okay, because since we are basically beginning
out of
that
order.
Particular scene. Well, the next question along our format was, what scene or scenes affected you most strongly? Did any of them bring tears to your eyes? Since you've been sitting on this the longest, Jennifer.
Oh, my God, I finally get to talk about this. Egwene dying pissed me off.
Yeah.
I'm still mad about that.
I think that's pretty universal, I think.
Yeah. Like, I'm not even sad. Like, I might be sad when I go through and reread it, because I haven't done my second read-through yet, but I'm just mad that she died. Like, why did you die? Of all the characters, she was the one who had the most to live for, because she had the whole, she was going to rebuild the world after Rand was done trashing it, and now she's dead. And it's just like, I can't even wrap my head around it. You know, I'm going to, like, make a little shrine to her at Jordan Con and burn offerings. I'm going to wear white ribbons at the opening ceremony.
Or red ones, I suppose, like as she did when she rode into Tar Valon after the great day.
The white ribbons are for mourning, so.
I know, but the red ribbons were symbolizing her, you know, her victory and all that sort of stuff. That makes me think more of Egwene than the white ribbons would, probably.
Oh, okay. Anyway, that just made me mad.
Yeah. She was so good and so awesome, and she, as you say, she had so much to live for, and there were so many things she needed yet to do, and she was so young. And
Galad, oh my God, this is why I need to be able to swear.
Yeah.
Galad, I hate him so much because he was dumb and got her killed. I've always hated Callum, but now I hate him even more.
Those were the two scenes that made you angry. Were there any that moved you to tears?
The last page. That's the only part I've been able to reread is just that last page. I go back and I read what Jim wrote there, and it's such elegant prose, and it's some of his best writing, I think. And it's got that extra poignancy to it because Jim is not with us anymore. And it's like picking a scab. I go back and reread it and feel sad all over again.
Well, I was sort of surprised at some of the scenes that moved me. Obviously, the one with Egwene. I think when I first read that, I was too shocked to even be angry. I think the anger came later. I just was like, no, you can't do this. What? Wait, she's actually gone. I was really, really, really
upset. Not like a
shoulder
button or something?
Yeah. I mean, undo. We need undo. This can't be happening sort of thing. I mean, it was even more than some of the other things that were sad and shocking, but as in Gawain, shall we say, somewhat predictable. That one really, it just upset me on so many levels. I can't even tell you. So I don't know. I just can't really even process it. It's almost like losing a real friend, you know, that is actually in my real life. It was so unexpected. I really, of all the characters to die, I would have not had her in my top probably 20, just because, as you said, she had so much to live for, so much to do, et cetera, et cetera. And then really strangely, I don't know if it was just because I was maybe at a state of total exhaustion at that point in the reading or if it just hit me funny, I actually cried when Loghain had that scene where he's all wanting to find, you know, the Sangreal, and he's all going to do this and everything, and then he stops, and the woman thanks him. I'm trying to remember now because it's been so long, but she thanks him for saving the child, and he says that's the Black Tower protects always. And then you could just see the evil sort of melting out of him, and him realizing that he didn't need to make his mark by fear, but by being respected and admired, and how he could see in the future, you know, people bringing their children to the Black Tower, you know, and saying, I was like, oh my God, I can't believe it. That's so beautiful. It was really such a minor scene, but it just moved me. I can't even explain why. It just did. I was just glad to see that Loghain, he was so on the edge, and I really thought for so long that he might have actually been turned a couple of times ahead of it. And then he resisted for so long, you know, and went through so much. And then he was still right on the edge of becoming evil anyway.
Uh-huh.
And then he made the choice. And I thought, well, that's pretty cool. You know, this is a fitting person to continue on with the Black Tower, since Rand obviously is not going to have anything to do with it. And
yeah.
That sort of leads into one other question which should come later, which is an unresolved thing, so remind me about that when we get to it, about the one who's supposed to come after, not even being mentioned. So, Andrew, what was your most...
Honestly, at the very beginning, and I didn't think I'd be able to actually even get through certain parts, apparently, when I was reading some of the early pre-released material, apparently I never read the entire bit of any of it. So like chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 11, you know, they didn't release all of chapter 11, obviously, but, you know, the prologue. I had not read the full prologue in advance. So it was really weird that I didn't have all of it. And as I'm sitting there reading through things, the first moment that really struck me was Talmanis in Cain.
Oh, yeah.
And when I thought he had died, I was like, oh, that's really sad. And then, you know, he's alive, and Egwene doesn't even finish the sentence. Nynaeve just erupts with a spray of healing power, you know, and it does. The instant I read the word erupts, I was like, and here I am in the airport going, oh my God, I can't believe this, you know, and then tears in my face and stuff, and it just... You know, I'm sitting here sniffling, and I'm like, yeah, I have allergies, that's what it is. One of the other ones, I mean, there are a number of them, where I just, when Gawain rushed in to fight Demandred, I was like, okay, that makes total sense on multiple levels. And then when Demandred just dispatched him with barely, you know, blinking an eye, I was like... You know, again, almost furious and like yelling, and that repeated itself with Egwene. And then One of the moments that just is because I guess I could just picture it so much. The battle is going one way, and you know things are getting really tense in that, and you have poor little Ulver stuck in that stupid hole, you know, and just you know, he raises the horn, and I'm like, holy crap, you know, just it was like. Brilliance, because the instant he got trapped in that hole, I went, okay, Matt's not connected to the horn anymore. I saw it coming a mile away.
Wow.
But at the same time, when it happened, I was still like, yeah, that's it right there. Yes. One of the things, and this takes us back to Egwene, shortly after her passing, during Rand battling with you know, the psychic will of the Dark One in the blackness between reality and non-existence or whatever you want to call it. She, I mean, presumably it is her, you know, talking to him, you know, saying, you know, we sacrificed ourselves, let us do this. And Rand has this realization that they're all heroes. And I just really kind of expected that when the horn was blown, that Egwene would be there amongst the heroes of the horn. You know, It's just like, and the fact that we never got more than just a few names of the heroes, because, I mean, there were a lot of heroes. We just don't ever get a complete and comprehensive list. I kind of just expected that she was going to be there, just to have that one moment. So, you know, there's a little bit of kind of, where's Egwene? Okay, yeah, I know Birgitta gets back up, obviously. She was going to do that from, you know, there was just a lot of it, and then those last few moments, Tam and the pyre was a pretty kind of you know, because he's there and he survived. So yeah, and I don't know. I guess that kind of leads us on what surprised you most. I didn't see that coming type moments.
Things I didn't see coming. Well, definitely Egwene, I didn't see that one coming. I didn't see Swan and Gareth dying coming. I thought of all the characters, those two were going to get a happy ending with each other, that they would get to like ride off into the sunset and be the old married couple, you know, snarking on each other forever. I really thought that one was going to happen. I don't know. Like I said, I tried to come into this book with very little expectation so that any surprise would be a pleasant surprise.
That reminds me of Aaron's comment of prepare for the worst and then all your surprises will be pleasant ones. We should do a whole little book, you know, like the Wisdom of Chairman Mao or something like that, the collected sayings of Aaron Sedai. She was full of cute little homilies like that, even more so than Linny, because I think Aaron's were a little bit more to the point.
Uh-huh. Yeah, Linny would make up stuff.
Yeah. Well, I mean, she even admitted it. You know, at my age, if I say it, it's an old saying or something like that. You know, but I guess what I didn't see coming, I kind of saw it coming, but not in the way that it did when, and I loved it. It was so awesome when Pavara and Andral bonded each other. There were so many cute little moments in that. That just like, well, you did it first. But, you know, it's like, come on, guys, get a life here. You're fighting for life and death, and you're like freaking out. But then they started using this communication, and now they're having a telepathic bond. And I thought, well, that's really interesting. I mean, there was some foreshadowing of it in the linkage between the three Taviren boys, which I was kind of surprised wasn't developed further. I really thought that would be a key to them winning the last battle, to be able to communicate with each other when widely separated on the battlefront, but didn't happen.
Turned out to not be necessary to do that, so didn't happen.
Yeah, I guess it just wasn't necessary, but I thought that was really interesting. You know, not only to be able to feel where they were and share some of their emotional feelings and so forth and so on, but to be able to actually communicate, you know, like having a conversation, coherent sentences back and forth, that's awesome. You know, what a shame that was wasted. I mean, not wasted, but what a shame we didn't find out about that until the last book. It makes me wonder if more Aes Sedai and Aeshaman are going to attempt doing that back and forth.
Uh-huh.
And let's see, I guess what else that I just didn't see coming was I guess I didn't see some of the things that happened with Avienda really coming. I was expecting, but sort of in a negative way, I was expecting more of a dramatic resolution to that than what it was. It was satisfactory, but I was thinking that was leading somewhere else, which I'm not even really sure where it was, but it kind of went, oh, okay. And I didn't have a lot of emotional attachment to the ending, but it was kind of just sort of surprising. It's really funny because I really didn't see her being injured, and surprisingly, very few characters were actually, main characters were actually injured. You know, I was sad to see Galad lose an arm, but then I suppose that was not to be expected. I guess the other surprising thing was, Andrew and I were sort of talking before you joined us, Jennifer, about our dear beloved Val of the Wild, Demandred, and how, as I recall, correct me if I'm wrong, but he was not one of the greatest swordsmen in the world in the Age of Legends. I think that was one of the many things where he was second best to Luce Theron, as he was in so many ways. And I don't see anything about a Sahungriel that would necessarily have increased his mastery of the blade. So I was really surprised that he was not only able to dispatch Gawain, who was awesome and defeated three blood knives single-handedly, but his brother Galad is better than Galad. Better than Gawain. That shocked me. I just did not. Not only did I not see it coming, I don't even know why it was so. It didn't make sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose we're led to believe that while he was in Shara, he found some kung fu master or somebody who could teach him the blade and all of its finer nuances while he's gathering all these armies. But
what I've been told is there's several chapters of A Memory of Light that deal with Demandred and how he got to be so awesome and got to be like the head dude of Shara. And they were taken out because the book was already 900 pages, so they had to take something out. That was one of the things that could be taken out and still but there's going to be an anthology published in a few months. I can't remember the details on it, but it's a fundraiser for an editor who has some extensive medical bills. And so his way of paying for his medical bills is he asks all of his writer friends, hey, putting together an anthology, what can you contribute? And Brandon got Harriet's permission to contribute the missing chapters of A Memory of Light to it. So
cool.
There's going to be something called The River of Souls. But yeah, that's going to be coming out in a few months. And so we can see what happened with Demandred.
Okay.
That particular collection, for those listening, it's for Michael Sullivan is the author. He had more than $200,000 in medical debt accrued with his fight with cancer recently.
Yeah.
As a result, several contributors, including Terry Brooks, Patrick Northfuss, Naomi Novik, Brandon Sanderson, R.A. Salvatore, Tad Williams, Jacqueline Carey, Daniel Abram, Peter V. Brett, Robert V.S. Reddick, Peter Orlin, I'm going to butcher some of these names, I am sorry, Todd Lockwood, Carrie Vaughn, Blake Charlton, Kevin Hearn, Mark Lawrence, David Anthony Durham, Jennifer Bosworth, Lev Grossman, Michael J. Sullivan himself, Eldon Thompson, and Sean Speakman, and the anthology is entitled Unfettered. Yeah, the Unfettered Anthology.
That's really awesome.
Yes, I had just re-seen an advertisement for it earlier today, so that is why I was like, oh, I can just hit back in my browser history and get directly that information.
While I was talking.
What fortuitous circumstance be this? No, that is a crossover we haven't done before.
As for myself, one of the pleasant surprises, one of the pleasant things I didn't see coming was the appearance of The Last Hunt. I mean, I knew that the Dark Hounds were going to show up. I did not expect there to be wolf heroes of the horn that would show up. I mean, just the fact that giant glowing wolves appeared in Shia Ghul, and I was like, holy crud, that's awesome. Didn't see that one. I obviously did not see Egwene or Galad. Trying to think, because there were just a number. I was a little surprised by the rampant araming of characters. because it seemed like there were a lot of characters, some of them pretty big and some of them relatively minor, that had, you know, multiple chapters devoted to them, or they appeared throughout most of the series, and it was like, oh, so-and-so got crushed by a horse, and so-and-so, and it was resolved in such the shot by a trolloc arrow method that I was kind of like, oh, I kind of would have liked just a little more about them dying. I mean, I obviously, you needed that kind of pow, pow, pow shock of Rand seeing it all happening and being like, oh my God, I'm failing everybody right now.
It's very interesting that a 14-book series ends with a 900-page book. And we're all like, ooh, why can't there just be a little bit more?
I know.
Clearly, we aren't the ones here.
Well, and the biggest one I didn't see and was really surprised by in this, like I said, slew of what I have now termed as Araming, was Shadar Haran.
Yeah.
They didn't even mention his name. It was like, oh, look, there's a Murdrel husk on the floor. I'm like, really?
Right.
He was just
thrown
a cocoon?
Thrown away like an old pair of shoes.
I mean, he was the creepy eyeless cocoon for the giant, you know, omnipresent black void butterfly. What?
Super fade. He's a super fade, man.
He was an egg, apparently.
Yeah.
I was also a little surprised because we didn't see Padden Fain until like 800 pages into the book. It was just like, there was such an ominous, he appeared in Gathering Storm and was just like, ooh, zombie Trolloc.
Oh,
you know, and
thank
and,
you.
And
thank
out
you,
of nowhere.
Brandon, thank you. No zombie Trolloc.
It was just that. And as much as we originally complained that Hinderstep had to have been a Brandon creation, considering the fact that they showed up again, I was like, that's brilliance, and so makes so much more sense as to why that incongruent town would have existed at all if they had a purpose for the last battle. I mean, just out of blindsided me, because he's like, I didn't understand why he had those, and then Grady was just sitting there thinking, you know, sure, they had 100 members of the band, and I was like, why does that sound familiar? That really sounds familiar, that there was a specific chunk of the band who obviously was sent up there to die, and like, why would they do that? And he's like, open the portal. What was the town's name again? And I'm like, oh, I didn't even have to read the next word. I was like, oh my God, how did I not catch that? Yeah,
I never saw that coming either. It took me a while to kind of for that to sink in. I didn't realize when I first read past that that was Hinderstep and the people from Hinderstep. But then we never find out what happened to them.
Because it included children.
We never find out what happened to them either. I mean, when the Dark One is contained again, did the town go back to normal? Did all these things heal up? I guess they did, but we don't really know.
Yeah, we know absolutely nothing about what happens after the last battle. Other than there's kind of a funeral later.
I love what happened with Matt. I mean, Padden Fain tried to Arum him in the back, but it didn't work. He was immune. I never saw that coming. It was obvious in retrospect, but I did not see that coming, that Matt could just deal with him.
Or rather that Matt was the perfect person to deal with him.
Oh, yeah, in retrospect, sure. But I didn't.
Yeah.
I probably didn't think of that in advance. I didn't think that anything would be immune to that dagger's influence or the influence of Mashadar. It seemed too big to me. I just didn't think that that would work that way. And it's great that it did.
Yeah. Worked out for everybody.
Oh, yeah. Well, except for Mordus and company. And he finally got his new name. And then he gets killed. Oh, too bad, Ben. And I just have to take this second. I sort of was interjecting there earlier. Sorry, but thank you, Brandon, for minimizing the zombie Trollocs. I have this thing about zombies in the general. I'm just not into the whole zombie apocalypse thing, and having zombie Trollocs showing up was kind of like,
really?
No.
I kind of like the zombie Trolloc idea.
I thought they were creepy enough. They didn't need to be zombies.
That Walking Dead fanfic I've always wanted to do.
And I just had to whine about stuff. Sorry. So I didn't miss the zombie Trollocs in this one at all. They were only referenced. They never really showed up. So that was good. I was afraid they were going to be an integral part of the last battle. One thing I have to interject, which has just been bothering the heck out of me, is where in the world did the Shadow keep all these hundreds of thousands of Trollocs, and how did they feed them in the Blight for all these years? How long does it take to raise up a Trolloc anyway? It must be a pretty quick turnover or something. And how did they get so many of them through that cellar in Caimlan before anybody noticed? I mean, 10 Trollocs would have filled up the cellar.
This is just a thought. Maybe the Trollocs are kind of like the Jem Hatar from Star Trek Deep Space Nine.
Oh, my God.
You know, 3 is an honored elder. You know, maybe they grow to adulthood really fast and are designed to be cannon fodder, so they don't really live all that long.
My guess as well. We did, though, at Dragon Con last year, come up with this very complicated and sophisticated Trolloc economy where there were, like, classes, like bourgeoisie Trollocs that could afford to wear pants and, like, work in factories and workers who needed to seize the means of production. It was very, very complicated.
Okay, so Narg must have been, like, a princeling among Trollocs then.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Trollocs get their pants. Is there, like, a whole, like, you know, Trolloc economy? Do they, you know, they trade pants with each other? Like, they're all wearing pants, but where did they come from?
And who does all that laundry? Well, I guess they don't do much laundry, but, I mean...
They can't get the bodies of people they've killed because they're 9 feet tall.
Yeah, exactly. They get them from the same place as the Incredible Hulk. That's all I can say.
That makes sense.
They're magic. You know, yes, pants that fit Bruce Banner somehow managed to fit the Hulk. Oh, okay. It's called willing suspension of belief, I guess. We just have to do it.
It's a whole book series about people who, you know, can, you know, shoot fireballs out of their hands and teleport through magical gateways. If this is the thing that's going to take you out of the story, that's going to make you think, no, that can't happen, you're reading the wrong thing.
Well, I've always said I can live with almost any sort of a plot line if I don't see the wires, but that's kind of coming close. I'll tell you another one that bothers me, and this logistics stuff has bothered me a lot, and I've mentioned it in several podcasts. It's probably not the time to do it, but the idea that they were going to lure these Trollocs out of Caimlan 50 leagues to Braem Wood is absurd. Not even a mechanized division is going to follow somebody for what is basically approximately 150 miles. I mean, a league is considered to be 2.6 to 5 miles.
Okay.
So they're not going to lure anybody out and have them chase you for even if it's a tenth of that, even if a league is half a mile in Jordan land, it's never going to happen. I mean, they might chase you a little while, but even the Morondians wouldn't chase somebody off for that long. It beggars belief. And then that was one thing that kind of jolted me out of the story. And they did it a couple, they said it mentioned it a couple of times. I went, oh, come on, really? I don't think so. I don't think even the Trollocs would be that stupid. And they had Fades running them. So it doesn't seem likely to me. But I mean, them going back to the food source thing, I look at the Trollocs kind of the way I look at when I go to a dog show and I see the Mastiffs in the ring and I see these 200-pound dogs. I'm going, my God, how much food does it take to feed that every day? And then I start calculating up stuff because I'm just one of those anal people that does that. And I start thinking, okay, if they got 100,000 Trollocs, that is one. Even if they eat every village along the way and every cow and everything else, it's like, I don't see how they can keep them supplied unless they start eating each other. I don't know. The other one that has massively bothered me from the first time I read it was when Birgit relates her tale of going through the Tower of Genji with Gael Kane, and she's dragging him on a litter, and she brought 2 months worth of supplies for the two of them. I'm thinking to myself, really? Do you have any idea how much 2 months worth of water would weigh, let alone food and torches and oil and all this other stuff? That must have been a litter, you know, with a tank division behind it or something. I don't know. A pocket universe attached. I don't know. It just can't happen. Sorry.
That's a standard D&D adventurer's backpack.
Yes, I know. They've all got little pocket enclaves. They've all got Hermione Granger running them with their little beaded bag. I know, but those are the kind of things that I have a hard time suspending my disbelief on, you know. I'm the person that packs the car for the dog show, so it's like, okay, that's not going to work. It really doesn't work for me, but I love it anyway. I don't care. I will suspend my disbelief long enough to enjoy it.
Before we move on, I will say, and we're going to be releasing some audio that was taken at the BYU bookstore a little later, but one question that had been asked by someone who had written into the podcast included questions on what things did Brandon want to include that he just didn't get a chance to. And one of the things that he did mention, since we've been talking about Trollocs, is that he had really wanted to put in another talking Trolloc, but he kind of felt that it was going to be, and I'm paraphrasing what he said, he thought that that would be just a little too much, maybe. You know, he would have liked to have had another one in there, but, you know, maybe Narg was enough. And I very quietly said, well, you know, we could have had Narg's wife show up. That would have been happy to me. You know, just to complain about Narg. Narg, no, come home. We have
Trolloc
babies to feed. I blame you, Randall Thor.
I'm coming for you, Randall Thor.
But being that I didn't guess that right, I guess the question is, what things that you guessed about the series did you get right? Because a lot of us have speculated for quite a while on things. You know, did you have anything that you had a hunch about that you just nailed dead on or were really close about?
I've always suspected that Shara would have a role in the last battle because it seemed kind of silly to have the whole continent off to the side that didn't really get dealt with, because the Shan Chan showed up to the party, so why not the Sharan? I didn't really realize or didn't think that it would be Demandred and that they'd all be subverted to the shadow, but I figured they would be involved somehow because, you know, that just seemed like a no-brainer there. Can't think of anything else right now.
Well, the missing Songreel that I mentioned before has been bothering me for 6 books or something. That showed up. I was glad to see that. I knew it was going to be somewhere. I couldn't imagine that he would have dropped such a broad hint and then not had it show up. But I did not get how it showed up and who had it. I really, really, really had my money on the fact that somehow Moraine was going to be able to dig it up, either because of her experiences, you know, with the Ilfin and the Elfin, or some other sort of knowledge, or possibly Cad Swain and Min might have figured out where it was from all their studies. But I didn't see Demandred coming up with it. That was my big catch, was the Sinéa Songreel. I knew that had to show up somewhere.
Yeah.
As far as stuff I didn't catch, Min being her Fortuana's two speaker, never ever saw that coming.
Oh my god, that was so awesome.
Never saw that coming. That was, I hope she got out of her clutches.
The thing that I loved, that I, when I read it, I went, yes, I can completely believe I called it, but, you know, the fact that I was right, I actually said it would be so amazing if near the end of the book, we got to the words, the wind was not the end. There are neither, you know, beginnings or endings to the Wheel of Time, but it was an ending. And the fact that those words appeared, I was like, yes, thank you for validating me.
Nailed it.
that one, I was like, yeah, because I kind of half expected it not to happen. You know, it was like, you know, it would be neat if it happened, but I think it would kind of also be a little bit of a stretch. And then he was like, the wind blew westward. And I'm like, they're going to do it. Yeah, awesome. I also, even in our last minute predictions that we released right before the midnight release of the book, I had said, well, I kind of figure that Gawain's going to put on all of the freaking blood knife rings at once and do something incredibly, you know, possibly amazing, but at the same time, probably really stupid and get himself killed. And I don't think anyone was surprised that I was right about that. I mean, he was just like, oh, come on, really? So
yeah, that was a really broad foreshadowing.
Those are my big ones. Ooh, another one, I just remembered now, one more thing that completely surprised me that I did not see coming. Bella.
Yeah.
Did not see that they killed Bella. Mandarb survived.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, it was
not
like,
Bella.
Oh my. And you know, and it almost, they almost aramed Bella.
Yeah, and I had my I had my request in for the Bella Mandarb babies when they came along. You know, I wanted one from the first foaling there, but nope. I did get one thing right, but not in the exact way. I really felt very strongly after what Varen said that a great and significant portion of the last battle would be fought in Tel Aranriad, and it was. But I envisioned Rand doing it more than Perrin, and I guess it was kind of an obvious thing with Perrin being in the wolf dream that he would be doing it, but I sort of envisioned them together, you know, fighting in Tel Aranriad rather than Perrin backing him up while he's dealing with the Dark One. And I never saw him figuring out how to get in and out of the flesh, in and out of Tel Aranriad in the flesh, and I never foresaw Lanfear helping him. That was out of left field for me.
Yeah.
Did not see that coming.
Yeah, Lanfear and the whole Perrin thing. Oh wow, that was.
Yeah.
I had no idea where that was going. It was going in interesting places, but I didn't know where we were going on this ride.
And then it just disappeared. I mean, the whole thread just kind of dried up. I mean, I have to say I was a little unhappy with that, but I was really glad to see Lutheran, I suppose, or Rand get the closure with her by coming to the conclusion that he was done with her and just walking away. I didn't see that coming, but I was hoping that he would. I really didn't think he'd be able to. You know, I didn't.
One thing, I expected another Tam Rand, you know, interaction thing, another father-son moment, and I'm glad we got that. I didn't see Master Luan having a basically father-son moment with Perrin.
Yeah.
That I was pleasantly surprised about, and I'm glad that, you know, in the same way, they both father figures kind of gave the same sort of advice to help their son figures past the thing that was kind of holding them back. But once Master Luan had his thing, I was like, okay, so when are we going to get to see Matt and Abel talking? And that never happened. We got one little thing with Abel being like, that's my boy. But, you know, we didn't actually ever get to see them interact again. And that was a little sad because it's like, oh, you know, I would have liked to have seen, you know, Matt's dad being like, I'm proud of you, son. And, you know, Matt being like, yeah, damn straight you are.
There were a number of things that were interesting about that. Some of those things, there were a lot of things that didn't really get resolved for me that I would have liked to see. And I really resonated with what you said in the beginning of the podcast, Jennifer, about how here we are after 20 years and 14 books, and the last book is a 900-page book, and there's still people saying, but I really wanted to see more. I wanted to see this. And there were a lot of little things that didn't get resolved that I would have liked to have seen resolved. And we were talking about one of them in the beginning of the podcast, and I had it in the front of my mind. Can you refresh my memory on that?
Well, I have actually, in preparation for this particular podcast, been reading a number of customer reviews of the book. And they range very broadly from people who are such fans of the series that, you know, it could have been three words long and they would have given it 5 stars. And to people who were like, I just can't be satisfied because this didn't happen and they never mentioned what happened here and,
uh-huh.
you know, this and...
Where
and,
was the follow-up hand?
But, I mean, the big one that a lot of people seem to be critical of is Rand's state at the end of the end of the book. He reaches out, he can't find either Sidon or the true power, and then he wills his pipe to light,
uh-huh.
and it happens. And people are like, that defies the laws of the universe. And my personal reaction to that was, the universe is a big place. You know, you can't have everything locked down there. Not everything, at least for me when I'm reading, needs to be explained. I just, you know, yeah, Rand kind of became a little godlike at the end.
Yeah.
Well,
they were actually talking about that at the Charleston signing last weekend. Maria and Harriet both talked about that, the ending. and how inexplicable it is that Rand can just sort of do things. They don't know why either. that's in the book exactly how Jim wrote it. He wrote it like that, with Rand doing something, doing that. It's word for word how he wanted it to be. And they don't know what he intended either. So no one knows. Robert Jordan took that secret to his grave.
I mean, like I said, I'm trying to remember a quote from somewhere else, but something to the effect of, you know, there are far more things, you know, in this world / you know, universe than your mind can comprehend, or something like that. I mean, just the idea. And you know, I'm satisfied with that. There was another issue, and it is a question over whether it was a continuity issue or whether just the rules for particular things. Egwene's death is based on the predicate that she was able to draw more power than even using the Fa'ang reel she could handle. But a lot of people are arguing that wasn't Kalendor the only Fa'ang reel that was specifically mentioned to have the flaw that you couldn't, or that you could overdraw? Like, was all other Angreal and Fa'ang reel supposed to be immune to overdrawing the power?
No, I've never understood that. That's never been my understanding of how Angreal and Fa'ang reel work. And I'm sure you'll have like 500 listeners pop up in the comments and be like, no, Jennifer, here's a bunch of quotes to prove you wrong. Yeah, I've always thought that you can potentially overdraw using Angreal and Fa'ang reel. It's just a lot harder. You have to be a crazy person to try to draw that much of the power.
So I was always of the opinion, since they made such a point several times in the book of mentioning the fact that Kalendor was apparently rather unique amongst Angreal in that it lacked the buffer that made it safe to use. And so from that, perhaps incorrectly, I inferred that it was common for them to have the buffer, and that Kalendor was somewhat unique in that respect, just because it was mentioned so often that it lacks it. So I got to come down on the other side of that. I really was surprised when Egwene was able to use Warra's Fa'ang reel to overdraw, because I thought it was, you know, standard operating procedure that they have this buffer. But apparently I was wrong, because she certainly was able to use that. Either that, or she was just so made of awesome that she was able to override anything, including buffers or anything else, and just do whatever she needed to do. Which is kind of where I come down on it. She was just so unbelievably powerful and awesome. It didn't matter if it had a buffer or not. She wanted it. She wanted it. She took it. She got it. That's it. She's done. But why she turned, you know, I don't know. And then she finds this weave all of a sudden that can, like the anti-balefire weave, that can heal up all the black cracks with crystals. It's, wow. Okay. That's cool. Didn't see that coming. So then she overdraws and turns into a giant crystal, not dragon mount, but wow. I mean, it was unbelievably cool, but it was like, oh, wow, that's unprecedented.
Here's a thought, and it might be way off base, but the more I'm thinking about Kalendor, it seems like I remember vaguely there being a mentioning that the buffer that Kalendor didn't provide was the one that buffered against the taint, because the known flaw in Kalendor was that it actually magnified the taint, as opposed to somewhat shielding the user from the amplified effects. So that I guess originally the concept during the breaking was that any male Angreal allowed them to channel more of the one power with the standard amount of taint, as opposed to, excessive amounts of taint. And that Kalendor was flawed in that it didn't have any buffer against the taint, and it actually magnified that kind of... And my memory on that is very vague. If there's anyone who can substantiate that, please feel free to comment or send us an email so that I can find that reference again, because like I said, it's a very distant memory, but I almost wonder if maybe the buffer that Kalendor was not providing was actually just a buffer against the things that couldn't.
See, here's the thing. It's the Aes Sedai are the ones talking about Kalendor and the buffer and the taint and all that. The Aes Sedai get proven wrong a lot. So I don't really blink an eye when somebody says this is so, and this is how it's always going to be so, And then later on we find out that's not so, because there's several points where, you know, characters that we perceive as being infallible at the beginning of the series, like Moraine, are found out to be working from flawed information. And so I just took it as the White Tower's understanding of Kalondor was the thing that was flawed. It works differently than what they think it does.
Okay. I kind of come down on the side of, as I recall from Rand's visit through the pillars when Kalondor was made, it was made very late in the last age, just prior to the breaking. All the Angreal and Sangreal, that basically almost all of them were made prior to the breaking, so there was no Tate for them to buffer against, so they wouldn't have even thought to include such a thing. Possibly since Kalondor was made so late and the men were starting to go mad already, they included such a buffer or didn't include such a buffer, but I don't think that they knew enough about why the men were going mad to have done that. I believe they made it as something that the dragon would reborn would need, but I don't think they took the taint into their calculations. That's just my speculation, simply because it seemed like a rather last-minute hasty creation that they're putting away for, you know, the future use of the Dragon Reborn, along with the Well of Sidene, the Eye of the World, et cetera, and the Banner, so that he would be prepared for what he needed to do. But I'm just going to come down on the side of, since most Angreal, Sangreal, and Turangreal were created pre-breaking and pre-taint, that
right,
the buffer has nothing to do with the taint. It's only a buffer against overdrawing. So that's just where I'm going to come down on that. I just don't think it has anything to do with the taint at all. But, you know, I certainly could be wrong on that, too.
Well, the other thing, too, we didn't really get much information about Vora's rod as well.
No, we don't.
It might not be that Kalondor is so unique.
As I recall, Vora's Sangreal appears first when they're trying to free Matt from the dagger, and I think it's repeatedly mentioned that it's one of the, if not the most powerful Sangreal that the White Tower has in its possession. And then, as far as I know, the next time we see it is when the White Tower is attacked and Egwene gets it out of the storeroom to use against the Seanchan attack.
Yeah.
So we really don't have a lot of information about it. But it just seems to me only logical that if the Aes Sedai of the Age of Legends are making something that's going to allow a channeler to draw more of the One Power than they can safely draw without this artifact, that it would only make sense for them to put in a buffer that would keep them from drawing so much that they'd kill themselves, and or create something on the order of Dragon Mount by drawing so much of the One Power into themselves that they not only destroy or burn out themselves, but, you know, massively destroy or alter all of their surroundings for a certain area. I mean, that would be something that you would think, you know, you would really want to avoid. I mean, it would be bad enough if a person just overdrew and burned themselves out, but if they're going to be able to draw enough of the One Power to create something like Dragon Mount and have basically the effect of dropping the nuke on the surrounding area, they would definitely want to have some sort of a buffer in there, I think, and I think that's what it was. Was just against drawing too much, and I think it, just my opinion, I think it was probably put into every one of them. I think it wasn't put into Kalondor either because they thought that maybe the Dragon Reborn would need something that had no limits in order to fight the Dark One.
Right.
Or they made it so hastily that they didn't get it done right. I don't know which. I sort of lean toward the former. I think they put in a Sangreal that had no limits just because they felt like they needed to give the Dragon Reborn everything he needed to do. The age is ending, the world's breaking. Obviously, somebody's going to come back in time, you know, going to be reborn sometime in the future and be the Dragon Reborn, and here's the stuff we're leaving him. Guard this well, last of the Green Man. What was he? The Nim.
Last
of the Nim. Yeah, last of the Nim. Guard this well, you know, last of your kind, and here it is. It was kind of a last-ditch effort, I think.
Uh-huh.
But just because an Angreal or Sangreal has a buffer built in doesn't mean that somebody with enough power or determination might not be able to override it anyway. I mean, there are plenty of examples of technology in our world where it's designed, you know, to be safe, but somebody with sufficient skill or knowledge can get around it, make it do more than it has. I mean, a very mundane example is people overclock computers all the time.
Right.
They're not supposed to, and, you know, if you do it wrong, it can basically turn your computer into a really fancy brick, but you can do it.
In the same way, it's kind of also like the control rods in a nuclear power plant. I mean,
yeah.
You know, they have redundancies to keep them from failing, but at the same time, we've had numerous meltdowns since the inception of nuclear technology. So
yeah.
I guess it is possible that, you know, we might be able to make an argument that given enough will, determination, and sheer just use of the power through an Ongreal or a Songreal, you could technically break it.
Yeah, or just override it, you know.
Yeah.
Well, there's all kinds of examples I can give you with really advanced technology that have all sorts of fail-safes and stuff put in there, but if somebody with enough skill or determination can usually get around them. I mean, you can get around buffers easy. You can get around fail-safes easy if you know what you're doing. I think Egwene was just so strong and so determined that she was able to blow past whatever fail-safes were installed in that Songreal or built into it and just did what she needed to do. I mean, I almost think of her as sort of the opposite, if I may make a little crossover, of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, when Willow became Dark Willow and just became so incredibly powerful, but she was like for the light. I think she was just so incredibly powerful and so in tune with the source of the power and everything else. I think she was at the point where she almost didn't even need Boris or Ongreal to do what she did. She was like Lucerne creating Dragonmount. He didn't need an Ongreal to do that. He just did it. You know,
yeah,
she was at that point.
It's a similar thing that happens with Lucerne creating Dragonmount in an act of destruction and Egwene killing herself in an act of creation to save everyone.
Self-sacrifice. So, well, you know, she always said, Aes Sedai are servant of all.
Uh-huh.
And she always said that the Amyrlin Seat should be willing to do herself what she asked any of her Aes Sedai to do. So I think that was just where she was coming from. And I think she was at that moment of awesomeness. I mean, we saw glimpses of it when she fought the Shan-Chan. I mean, she was just unbelievably powerful, I think, even beyond what that Ongreal gave her.
Uh-huh.
I think that basically gave her the key to drawing that much power without needing an Ongreal. I mean, she may have carried more Songreal when she did what she did, but I think she was at that point. I just feel like Lucerne was when he was at the point of despair where he created Dragon Mountain, pulled in that much of the power. She was at that point of awesomeness and self-sacrifice that she was able to do it. I think it wouldn't have mattered if she was carrying a rock in her hand. She would have been able to do that.
Uh-huh.
Because she was just at that level of awesomeness. But that's just my feeling. I guess maybe I'm trying to dress up her loss, you know, with enough incredibleness that it doesn't bother me so much, but I'm never, ever going to get over the fact that Egwene did that.
I know
why she did it. I'm glad she did it. It was the right thing to do, but, oh, Egwene, did you have to die? Come on.
That actually, there was another thing, and it was just because we were talking about Dragonmount and the Crystal Spire, which then collapsed, that brought a couple different thoughts to my head. One of which, and I totally didn't see it coming, was Andril using Dragonmount as a weapon.
Yeah.
Just like, oh, look, I'm just going to open a portal and let the pressurized lava and Dragonmount shoot out and destroy.
I know.
Was like, oh, wow.
I do love all the creativity with the use of gateways in the last battle.
Mm-hmm.
Windows peeking out over battlefields, lava, zombies, shooting cannons out of them. All of it's fantastic.
Yeah.
And one of those things that Brandon had said about the magic systems, because one of the people at the Q&A before the midnight release had asked about, since Brandon's kind of known as the magic system guy,
right.
You know, how did he deal with the fact that the Wheel of Time had a very established and non-Brandon magic system to it? And Brandon had said, well, he had always wanted to do stuff akin to Robert Jordan's magic systems, but whenever he would be in one of his own works and he'd be thinking of a magic system, he'd go, oh, but that's a little too close to Robert Jordan. He was like, you know, one of the big perks of getting to write these last three volumes was that he finally got to do these things that were Jordan-esque.
Yeah.
And they fit because they were Wheel of Time. And one thing he said that he really wanted to do was rather than introducing a whole bunch of new weaves that hadn't already been established in the Wheel of Time, was that he wanted to try to find new ways for existing weaves to be used. And the use of gateways throughout this entire last volume was really just a way of re-envisioning the same weaves we'd already seen. And that I thought that was really neat, including the nod back to the thing that the Aiel were known for doing, or Aiel channelers, which was picking a weave apart. And,
yeah.
You know, and showing that if something happened as a result of picking a weave apart, that it was horribly unpredictable. The fact that, you know, oh, look. Suddenly, you know, a really ugly woman carried Avienda back into the area and said that she needed healing.
Yeah, I loved when Andral opened the gateway in front of the people and then opened the other end of it behind them. So they're basically destroying themselves with their own weapons. I'm like, oh my God, that is inspired. You know, we saw a little bit of that in the last book where Rand and several of the other channelers have figured out that they don't need to waste the time memorizing the spot if they open a gateway a short distance away and then open another one. Because opening the gateway has allowed them to learn the spot, or using the gateway and landing in a place has allowed them to learn the spot well enough. So they just jump a short distance, then they know the place, and then they can leave from it. And that really got around one of the big limitations of traveling by gateway, and which actually undid Varen Sedai, because she didn't understand that either. And I'm surprised she didn't come up with that, because she's such a thinker. I'm really, really surprised that she didn't figure that little trick out. But I was just inspired. I mean, I have to say that was, to me, a moment of awesomeness that I was like, oh my God, that is so good. That is so good. I love it. Well, I thought when I saw Andral like that, Andral gets it with these gateways. He just has that's all he can do. But oh my God, he has had the most inspired uses of these gateways. The only thing he didn't do that I thought definitely would happen was, we've speculated before on the podcast, I think one of the coolest ways to probably kill somebody without anybody else really realizing it, unless they were in the channel or could see the weeds, would be to open a really tiny gateway inside somebody's head and have them stroke out on you. He didn't do that. I was really kind of surprised that he never used the gateway to really kill somebody that way or stop their heart. I mean, you know, basically, you know, do some major damage inside a person by opening a gateway. I was expecting to see him do that, but he didn't. But the way he used those gateways all over the place and making a tabletop gateway to look down on the battlefield, whoa, that was really cool. Except I did have one problem with Matt leaning over with his hand on the edge of it, because I thought the edges of a gateway were really sharp, but maybe it's only when it's opening, huh?
Yeah, I think that's when it's opening, because what it's doing.
Yeah, that kind of bothered me that he had his hand on the edge of it, but I guess it's okay.
Well, I think what it is that as it's opening, what it's doing is parting reality. So, you know, whatever's on either side of that opening line gets sliced. I mean, I'm thinking once it's standing open,
maybe it's
kind
okay.
of like an actual door frame itself, and you can just kind of...
Apparently it is.
I wouldn't say you'd be able to grip, but I mean...
Yeah, apparently it is. Because, well, it's canon now. There it is. Unless we want to call it a continuity error, apparently it is. I would have to say about weaves and the magic system, the only other thing that I could comment on with that was that I did feel that maybe there were some continuity errors in the last couple of books regarding healing. But then again, maybe... You know, maybe some of the channelers have learned better and so forth and so on. Throughout the Towers of Midnight and this book, there were always references to people healing just one thing or somebody a little way, and it was made a big deal of that Sashal, I think it was, no, was it, Shimitsu, was one of the only ones who could control a weave to that extent, that she could heal one thing wrong with a person and leave the other things, or heal just a little bit enough so that they would not die of the shock, but, you know, wouldn't bleed out, and that was made a big deal of, that she was one of the only ones ever that could do that. And then all of a sudden in Towers of Midnight and The Memory of Light, we've got all these channelers who are just healing a little bit or just healing some, and the Ashaman are doing it too. And I'm going, well, somebody sure learned something really quick that we didn't hear anything about. And it got everywhere. It traveled everywhere. I mean, everybody found out about it. So I was kind of surprised.
Yeah,
I really felt...
I paid attention to healing, so I wouldn't have caught that.
I really felt that was a little bit of a continuity error, but maybe it's just me being churlish. I don't know.
I actually do have a direct continuity error, unless, and there was a way I thought around it, but I don't remember. Pavara, she did retake the three oaths, right?
Yeah.
Okay, then having that on page 131.
Oh, goodness, we've got the page number now.
Oh my God, he's ready with a page number. When they bring up page numbers, it's bad news.
Imaren looks to Pavara Sedai and says, I want you to partially undo the weave blocking his ears so that it seems like the weave is beginning to fail. I want him to hear what I have to say next. He then talks for a little bit, making it seem as if he is this grand mastermind setting up a gray tower. And at the end of it, he looks at Pavara Sedai and says, he can't hear what we're saying, can he? And Pavara looks at him and says, no.
Oh,
Pavara
that's a lie.
Pavara is completely aware that he can hear and says no. She tells a lie.
Things like that.
That's a good catch. Damn.
And you got the page number for it. There is a thread on Dragamount that Team Jordan is checking, so they're already going through it and looking for what they're going to do for the continuity fixes for the next edition. So
yeah, I noticed
things
too.
Like that. Yeah, go post stuff like that on Dragamount so that they can all be in one place.
I did that last year with my biggest catch, the famous Mandarb, or not Mandarb, Tie-Dye Shar, and the magic appearing and disappearing testicles. Now he's a gelding, now he's not. Yeah, that was probably my big catch of the decade. Anyway, oh, that's really interesting, though. I didn't catch that. Honestly, I did not catch that at all. Yeah, she did just pop out with a little lie there. Interesting. And didn't even, they could have got around that. They could have, had her say some little eyes and eye slippery sort of way to do it. But,
Yeah.
Well, they'll figure out a way to fix it.
Well, I think this will wrap up our episode on our first impressions of the last book of this massive series, Wheel of Time. We hope you've enjoyed going through it as much as we have. I'm sure we'll all be rereading it again more than once. I know I'm already on my second reread. Thank you very much for joining us, Jennifer. We really appreciate you taking your time to be with us.
Yeah, this was a lot of fun. Thank you for having me again.
It's always a pleasure. Always a pleasure. So this is Virginia wrapping this episode up, saying may the light illumine you until we meet again.
And for myself, Andrew Gellos, and everyone here at the Fourth Age, Saravya Ninto Manshima, Daishite. I can't find the shut off button. Yes, Spencer, I swear this is better not go at the end after the song is done playing.
It's going to show up in the outtakes. You know it is.